supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY.
Welcome to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. I'm your host, Jamie Brunson. Please call me Jamie J. And I am here in the studio with
Elizabeth Perez Luna from WHYY.
Elizabeth and I are also playing host today to two accomplished and powerful women, Khalida Sethi, a licensed clinical social worker. Welcome, Khalida.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Happy to have you. And Dr. Marquita Williams, counseling psychologist and senior advisor to the Philadelphia Community Behavioral Health Department. Welcome, Dr. Marquita.
Thank you.
So, Elizabeth and I just finished up an episode where we took stories, real life stories, and kind of put them on the couch with Dr. Lawrence Real, the chief medical officer of the Department of Behavioral Health. And Dr. Real kind of unpacked each story for us and helped us to understand what was going on in there. And part of the episode, we talked about how behavioral health issues are represented in the media, particularly films. Not one of these films represented a woman of color. So, is it true that women of color do not have behavioral health issues as represented by the films we looked at?
I would think not. I would think not. We all have experiences that would lead us to need some support. Trauma, grief, loss, everyday stress, you know, all of the things that are happening affect everyone, Black women included. And what's missing is the truth of that experience for African-American women and people of color, I think, in general.
Why?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons why. Historically, there have been a lot of mistrust in communities. For the medical community as it stands, there are also many, many messages and perceptions about what it means to seek help, what it means about whether or not you are strong or whether or not it means that you are not resilient. And I've also heard people say with African-American women, like, it's almost like a slap in the face, right? Because it's like you've come from this long lineage of strength and of resilience and of this idea that, you know, within yourself, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps or maybe, you know, with the help of a family member or the help of a friend or the help of a clergy member. But to go outside of that circle and to seek some additional help and support, how dare you? We don't do that.
Khalida, how would you describe your unique perspective?
Well, I am an immigrant as well from Afghanistan. My family came here following the Soviet invasion. And there is a strong belief that we escaped the war and now we're fine and now we're safe. And there is just this, I grew up with this sense of denial. Like, we just don't talk about it. We continue to focus on our current survival rather than our past hurts. And doing so, stopping for a second and focusing on that past hurt would just be too hard. Mm-hmm. It would keep you from surviving now. So we just didn't do it.
I think, Jamie, when you mention my background in terms of having a PhD and the roles that I've served in the city of Philadelphia, there's also another side to that, too, that I think is really important for the conversation, that I grew up in an urban community, that I grew up in the context of a faith community. And so, you know, I think that all of that plays the role into the kind of psychologist that I am today. So, you know, I also wanted to talk about that as well, because I think we do seek help. We just don't seek it in the ways that you would expect.
Conventional ways of therapy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And I would like to say that as an African-American woman who suffered major trauma as a child within the household, my perspective comes from a family that had two attitudes. One is that we deal with trauma through silence. So we didn't talk about it. And two, I think in common with what Khalida was saying, you know, we're a working class family. We move on. we don't have the luxury mm-hmm. of being able to have therapists and, you know, you move on. And if silence was the way that you moved on, you did. So with that, I'd like to talk about what are the kind of things that create issues for us? You started to talk about it, Marquita, when you said things like grief and loss.
Mm-hmm. Grief and loss, toxic stress. You know, there are a number of researchers who are looking at the impact of being Black in America on the individual psyche. And, you know, we talk about micro and macro aggressions every day and the influence of poverty and the influence of institutionalized and systemic racism, as well as, you know, the things that happen in everybody's life. So I'm losing friends. I'm losing family. I'm in environments where there's violence. You know, there may be violence in my household. Like, all of that will leave residue on your psyche.
It's not uncommon mm-hmm. in terms of accent for me or in terms mm-hmm. of being Black or being a person of right. color, of being the other. Is that one of the pressures that the general population, if you want to call it this, I mean, I hate to use those terms, mm-hmm. tends not to understand or not to feel? How does that work in terms of the work you do as therapists?
When I think about providing mental health therapy or my own family and my own community, I think a lot about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? Like making sure you have all your basic needs met, like food, safety, security, and then you can do this higher order mm-hmm. thinking, this self-actualization, right? So if a lot of our communities are security and safety is not a guarantee. Being able to discriminate against people out loud is now accepted in certain communities.
That is all too common, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it creates trauma. Am I right? Is
yes.
that's
absolutely,
trauma?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And unfortunately, it is common.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't think that people really take into consideration having that kind of experience often mm-hmm. in your life, mm-hmm. what that does to the psyche and what that does to your state of behavioral health.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's the state of hypervigilance mm-hmm. that I think people of color have learned to adapt in order to survive.
Mm-hmm. Always on guard, looking for the next thing or being startled by it, because at some points I think those amongst us who have, you know, so I have a PhD. So in some circles, it's like, okay, so you are that X in a sea of O's, right? But then you're jarred back into, but you're still a Black woman. It's about, what do they do with that feeling, right? How does that feeling manifest in behavior or thoughts or actions, and bringing that, illuminating that? Because a lot of times we have experiences, we swallow them, we think, oh, they're gone. But then when you really sort of take time to unpack them, you realize, no, they're not gone. They manifest in this drinking behavior or this eating behavior or mm-hmm. this discord in my relationship or the depression that is sub-threshold and I'm not really talking about, or the anxiety right. that I feel every day like a heartbeat. And so I would really want to bring that to light, to really talk about what has manifested as a result of these experiences and then deal with that.
What about other experiences that are unique to women of color?
Recently, I've been working with a Muslim woman who covers with a hijab, and she had an experience with, you know, she lost a child, and she had asked me to refer her through a therapist who would also be Muslim. When I spoke to her further, I asked her more specific questions about what type of therapist she's looking for, and in the end, it boiled down to, I want someone who will respect me, who will not focus or ask me too many questions about my religion, but when I choose to talk about my religion, she's respectful and is open to listening. And this was a very important part of her seeking therapy, but I have to say it was incredibly hard for me to find her one.
Wow.
I personally did not have room for her.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Are you Muslim yourself?
I grew up in a Muslim household, yeah.
So you have a cultural competency, and I think we should talk about that word and what that means. I know, Dr. Marquita, you have some really interesting insights. But so we're talking about racism as a unique characteristic of the woman of color experience, and of course other mm-hmm. people of color. We're talking about religious acceptance, being able to respect and accept one's religion in the therapy room. Mm-hmm. What else?
Well, you know, women of color, we wear a cape, right? We're superwomen.
Wonder
right?
Woman.
We are superwomen, and we are expected to be all things to all people at all times.
With a smile.
With a smile. And it's accepted and expected. Right. And so if you walk through the world feeling that you have to do everything all the time for everybody else and smile while doing it, and it's the expectation of you, and somewhere inside you, you feel like, listen, I can't be all things to all people. Who do you tell that to? Who do you voice that to? Because it's accepted and it's expected, right? And so then imagine having that pressure on you all the time with no release, no real escape from it, and the expectation to continue to do it. So, I mean, I think that is the tremendous burden of the woman of color, and particularly of African-American women. And the idea that you can kind of get into your small circles of girlfriends and complain about it, but there also is still that expectation. We all go through this. Girl, you know, we're going to be all right. It's okay. You know, maybe we'll cry about it. Maybe we'll pray about it. Mm-hmm. But you go head back to that. That, I think, is killing us.
How so?
Struggling. We can't really give voice to what that pressure feels like every day. And I don't even know that we are often present to what the lightness of our life would be because we're used to living in the heaviness of that pressure and that expectation.
And it becomes the new normal.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Khalida, would you say this phenomenon is also relevant for Afghani women?
For South Asian women in general, I think our, you know, while we have a diaspora and people who have been here for generations and people who are newly arrived, within that there is a tendency to minimize mental health care needs. Mm-hmm. Another thing that does happen when people do seek mental health care is that so there is this therapeutic tool where we ask our clients to find the exception. But when your client comes to you and begins speaking to you about some of the toxic stress that she feels outside, you know, some of the discrimination, some of the other stuff, when you ask her to then find an exception, you're literally saying, but all lives matter, mm-hmm. not all men, mm-hmm. not all women. And it ends up being a tool for invalidating your client. And I've had that experience myself in therapy where my therapist has asked me to think of the people who are good to you. Think of the people who would not say these things. You know, it hasn't been necessarily this nuanced approach to caring for the whole person.
You know, there's a Christian understanding that says the power of life and death lies in the tongue, right? And I think that we have to speak the truth to our experience and begin to really talk candidly about what our experiences are. I liken it to in the women's movement with moms, you know, no mom wanted to talk about like how tough it really is to be a mom. And particularly we have several small children. And then all of a sudden people started saying, it's tough. Like, you know, it's a demands on you. And then, you know, more awareness came to what it was to be a mother and the responsibility of that, as well as, you know, postpartum depression and just the chaos that it can be when you have a lot of children. I think the same thing needs to happen with Black women around mental health. I do think it is happening that people are starting to say, you know, I am feeling depressed, or I did see a therapist. I didn't tell anybody at the time and it was helpful, or I have been in recovery from thus and so. Mm-hmm. I do think that that is the way that becomes a new normal. You have to begin to have these conversations. I also think, and I don't know if it's a good thing or not, but the media has really begun to sort of popular culture eyes, if that's a word, therapy. And so you will see, you know, these reality shows with the therapist that comes in, or, you know, dating shows and the therapist comes in, or a therapist is inserted into a conversation in popular culture. And so some of the stigma around having that level of professional in a room or in a space, you know, is dissipating a bit.
So let's go there. Let's talk about therapists. culturally competent therapists. Let's talk about the therapist. What do you need to get good therapy from someone as a woman of color?
One thing that I thought, even in graduate school, learning about therapy and about therapeutic theories, is that a lot of it was centered around whiteness and around European whiteness. When we talk about the family or the primary caregiver, it's primarily the mother. In my community particularly, we have multi-generational families. It's very common for grandmothers to be your primary caregiver, with several generations living in the same home. In fact, my mother would tell stories about how her and her 9 siblings would choose, in a house large enough to house them all in separate bedrooms, would choose to all be in the same room. Because there's this expectation of closeness. And there is no individual, there is an us. And that's very common and normal. But in learning therapeutic theory, I noticed there was no room for that. I had to learn about this very European, white-centric viewpoint of what family is composed of and what the self is even composed of.
And what did you learn?
I learned that there wasn't a lot of space for me and that I needed to add to that conversation.
So when someone comes to you and you know that, how do you approach it?
This is in line with our previous conversation as well about what you do when someone comes to you with their experience. And I think one of the missing links in society and with media tends to be validating people's experiences, being able to say, I hear you and I see you, and what you have to say is real.
So as a Black woman, do I need a Black woman therapist? Do I need somebody that sees things or at least understands the road I've taken?
I would say you do not need a Black woman as a therapist. Now, will it make you feel good to open that door and see a sister?
Somebody that looks like me.
I think it would. I think that we carry the notion, your blues ain't like mine, right? So if you see somebody that looks different or they seem different, you say, no, 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 you're going to count them out. But I do think, and, you know, literature says that if the therapist possesses the requisite knowledge, awareness, and skills, that that therapist can help you to move towards healing, however you identify your healing. But I do think there's something to be said about affinity bonds, right? If a therapist can recognize and understand a person from their cultural context, you're going to be able to develop a level of connection and affinity in that space to move forward in a different way.
But you're talking about the onus is on the therapist
to get
that training.
Well, yo, the therapist definitely has
absolutely
to get
that cultural training.
Yes, no question about it.
Absolutely.
It is an ethical consideration.
So how do I guarantee, you know, what's the question I ask when I go in? Have you had cultural training in the African-American experience? I mean, what is it? That's exactly what I should ask.
Absolutely. It's a great sentence.
You can ask, you know, have you seen African-American clients? You know, what is your experience and expertise in seeing African-American women? Have you had cultural competence training? You can ask the same questions we would go in with to vet our medical doctor on a condition, you know, that we are coming in to be seen for. You can vet your psychologist, therapist, social worker in the same way.
So the best way to make sure that you're working with the right therapist is to come in with a set of questions and ask them if they have experience in things that are important to you.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And I would research them. You know, you have that name. You know, you can look everything up on Google. So you can find out what a person's specialty is, what their experience is, how many years of experience they have, and then come in with your additional questions that you need answered to make the decision. A lot of times people come into therapy and they feel, this is it. Like, this is my doctor. I'm here. So, you know, I'm stuck with you. You're stuck with me. And it's not. It's an interview process
to
make sure that it's a mutual match.
And that relationship between the client and the therapist, all this research shows that that's actually a huge part of the healing process itself. When you have rapport with your therapist, you are able to then do some of that deeper work that's necessary for healing.
So are there particular therapists that focus on doing work with people that have been in these kind of crisis situations?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I was getting ready to ask. A part of the ethics of practicing is knowing your limitations, knowing, you know, what you're capable of addressing successfully with a client and what's not your area of expertise. You know, there's not a one size fits all to this, right? And so as a potential client is coming in asking questions, you want to make sure that the person understands your frame of reference and that you can trust, that they trust what it is that you're telling them. There are a number of therapists who specialize in trauma and specific types of trauma, sexual trauma, physical trauma, immigration trauma. And so as you're looking, you want to make sure that you find therapists who have some experience, some specialty, some understanding of what it is that you're seeking.
I want to ask this. Should I expect my therapist to save me? What is the expectation I should have?
Therapy is a participatory sport, right? Your therapist cannot save you from anything, but your therapist can help you get to the goals that you have set for yourself. So you got to be in it together. It's a relationship. You have to be able to get in the relationship, talk together, work together, build together, and grow together.
I work with children, and they come up with really colorful ways to say what the therapeutic process means to them. Mm. And one child once said, well, it's like I was carrying a heavy thing. And then I came, and you said, you can leave the heavy thing here.
Wow.
And that's all he needed.
That is beautiful. We've talked about some of the unique challenges that women of color face beyond the normal day-to-day stress being a woman creates. And we've talked about language, you know, dealing with people that don't respect our language and, you know, can be very hurtful. We've talked about facing stereotypes, racism, religious intolerance, and people that don't understand or appreciate the immigrant experience. Mm-hmm. And to be quite honest, it feels to me like if you didn't get angry or depressed, mm-hmm. something would be wrong mm-hmm. with you
Absolutely.
If you had to deal
mm-hmm.
with all of
yes.
these issues. Mm-hmm. I think I'd like to end our conversation with some stories of resilience, stories where you know that either yourself or someone else has overcome any difficulties to really achieve a successful, powerful life.
Absolutely. Like, so here's the good news. I think that in the last 10 years, African-American women have been seeking therapeutic counseling environment at a rate of about 20 to 25%. So we're coming, we're coming into spaces of traditional healing. But I also think what's important is that the system is responding in a more culturally appropriate manner in that we're not expecting people to come into us. So I've seen money put into programs where we went out into the community and addressed people where they live. So
right.
as you're talking about different Southeast Asian communities, we put money into opportunities where we knew that the trauma of immigration was real and the trauma of acculturation and trying to be in this country and adapt was real and was strong and was traumatic. So we gave money to build community gardens and we gave money to have knitting circles. And in those community gardening sessions, we talked about the trauma and we talked about the difficulty of acculturation and putting your child into a school where they didn't speak the language. And so because of that, the child was failing in school and how we needed to find other students who spoke the language to peer up so that they would be more successful in that environment. So it wasn't about us being a traditional mental health service provider and sitting in that traditionalism and saying, you have to come to us. But it was saying, we understand that we have to be culturally competent and meet you where you are and evidence healing in those ways. And so I think that not only from a systemic perspective, but as a community, we are resisting the history of being silent and seeking support.
Well said, Dr. Martina.
Oh, well, thank you.
So when you say we, who is we?
When I worked for the Department of Behavioral Health and Intellectual Disability Services, that city entity, now through CBH, like money is going into the community to make sure that there's access there and their availability of resources for all communities.
And that's essentially a culturally competent way to fund mental mm-hmm, health mm-hmm. within communities of color.
Mm-hmm.
In answer to your question, in terms of resilience, one of the things that I've personally started doing that I'd like to see more therapists also be able to do, and more trainings around this, is bringing in social justice into my therapeutic practice. Mm. Being able to say, you know, what you're experiencing is very real, and here are some statistics around it, but then also here's this resistance movement to that. Mm-hmm. And that can be healing in and of itself, being able to recognize that resistance is possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we're talking about healing from the effects of stereotypes, racism, language intolerance, we are talking about social justice. Mm-hmm. I want to thank Dr. Marquita Williams.
You're welcome.
And Kalida Sethi.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking today about the unique behavioral health challenges, resilience, and resources available to women of color around their behavioral health issues. As usual, I'm here in the studio with
Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I am Jamie Brunson. Please call me Jamie J. And we thank you for listening to Common Space on WHYY, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. Common Space has been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage.
And you can find us at acommonspace.org. That's acommonspace.org.
And you can always count on us to zoom in and zoom out of important issues around the pressing themes of our time.